I know everybody tonight's name Jim. Welcome to the recently named mentioned in dispatches. Round of applause all around. Yeah, we know that Cyrano was openly campaigning for mentioned in dispatches, and I have a feeling that every computer at work was told to go vote in order to stuff the ballot box. And as pants are overrated finished a close second, we could always adopt that as the motto of the podcast.
I was madly stuffing the ballot box for that one.
Yes. As long as you weren't madly stuffing the pants, we're fine.
I don't have any pants. Can't stuff them.
There you go.
They're overrated.
So with us tonight, we have a rather eclectic crowd. We have Doug. Howdy, Doug.
Howdy.
We have Vance. Howdy, Vance.
Howdy, eh?
And we have both Jims. Captain Darwin, how you doing?
Hanging in there.
All right. Chaotically disinterested?
I don't know if it was chaotically disinterested as much as it was what was chaotically indifferent. I can't remember.
Ambivalent.
Thank you.
He was so indifferent he couldn't remember if he was indifferent or ambivalent.
It was an 11-hour work day at work, so yeah, I need a little bit of leeway.
Yeah, and we have our good buddy Cyrano with us.
Good evening.
So I promised to piss Jim Cyrano off like right as soon as we started this whole call. Here's my question for you, and everybody else can riff on this as they choose. Jim, Napoleonic warfare. Why do we give a crap?
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, there's Napoleonic War Games coming out the end. Look, we can do the same conversation about the American Civil War as well, except that we don't have a ton of ACW guys on this call. However, I have you, our resident Napoleonicist. Why do we care?
Well, I'm going to get mad because you didn't give me enough time to prepare an answer.
That was kind of the point, really.
And I want to keep this to well under 2 minutes. I think I'll hit it two ways. Number one, we care kind of because it's baked into the cake of wargaming. You can go back as far as you want up to, from the time of Napoleon. Obviously, you can't go before him. But if you follow wargaming, both professional and recreational, and it is deeply imbued with Napoleonics. If you, for example, watch H.G. Wells' Little Wars and look at the illustrations and look what he's playing Napoleonics, a somewhat altered version of it, sure, but he's playing Napoleonics. And then by the time you get to Featherstone and Morshauer and all the other guys that were doing it, it's part of who we are. And certainly by the time you get to Duke Siegfried and those guys, almost everybody who did Scrooby's first minis are Napoleonic minis. So it's sort of in our genetics. It's in the DNA of wargaming, and it certainly was for me. And that was the first one I bumped into. If you're looking for a more esoteric reason, number one, it's pretty as heck. I mean, it's got an incredible panoply of uniforms and nations. It is truly a world war in many respects. You can argue about where it doesn't go, but it really does span the globe. You get these incredibly exotic units. Related to that, you have these incredible personalities that are so engaging, Napoleon himself, but also Wellington and Blücher and all these guys. And then finally, on a more technical point related to all this, much of what becomes our understanding of staff warfare and the development of military staffs and the development of the professional officer class is Napoleonic as read through Clausewitz. Clausewitz, who informs most of the Western way of thinking about war until pretty much now, he's a veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, and all his strengths and weaknesses are seen through that prism. So I just have always thought they were kind of awesome.
That was a lot shorter than the answer that that our good buddy Bill Wilder gave many, many moons ago back at Wargamer.com when he was reviewing he was ostensibly reviewing a Napoleonic War game for the website, and the review, even broken up for a website, still ran about 17 pages. And the actual and look, for folks that know Bill Wilder, that was a short review, right?
Yes.
But the actual review didn't start till about page 4 because of his treatise on why we care about the Napoleonics. And one of the key facets that he mentioned was that it's just so darn pretty.
Yep.
So, but I think one of the other points that he made was just the sheer scale of warfare at that level.
Yep. And as I think I said on the last podcast, visit, this Napoleon makes war at a level that essentially breaks the capacity of warfare at the time. And by the time he's engaged in after Wagram, after 1809, he's practicing warfare at a level that even he couldn't manage. So that says something.
Yeah. So, Doug, Napoleonic warfare, do you care?
Well, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, where else are you going to get to wear funny hats?
Well, that's true.
I mean, you can talk about all that other stuff, but at the end of the day...
I'm pretty sure there were funny hats both before and after Napoleon.
Oh, anywhere nearly as stylish.
Have you seen my hat?
I mean, nobody... Nobody does hats like Napoleon.
Not only have we seen your hat, Jim, we couldn't see you behind the hat.
Which is kind of the point.
Well, right? Yeah.
Hey.
There was a hat, there was a mustache, and I think there might have been a cigar in the picture somewhere. So, that was...
Now, I will say that while the hats are clearly... No one has ever rivaled Napoleonic hats. The wigs of the period prior to that, again, that's why the linear warfare period is important.
Man, you guys have a funny picture of war.
Well, you know, it's
gotta
hats and wigs. What are you
got to
be styled?
Let's keep in mind that Vance's Canadian perspective is slightly skewed by the fact that their hats were wigs and they were beaver pelts.
That's a point.
And keep your head warm.
So, Vance, Napoleonic warfare predates your country.
Oh my God, Snorefest, what? No tanks, no mechanized anything, no radios. Oh my God, my kingdom for a radio in this Kriegsspiel that we're playing.
And I've said this about Vance before. He is an incredibly good sport, and roles are assigned in the Kriegsspiel at random. That's on purpose so that people can try something else and not have to do the same thing if they came back in. But I can't get into too many details, but Vance drew a card that has left him, let's say, not in contact with the bulk of humanity for about 5 months, it seems.
Oh, and there's 5 months to go.
Yeah, and he's kind of hanging out going, hey, you guys fighting anybody?
Anybody out there?
It's just, because it's cool over here. I just rewatched Ghostbusters with my son, and you just so much your character, your email reminded me. Yeah, oh, of course. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
No. Yeah, you remind me so much. So we're over here marching, and if you wanted to fight, that'd be cool. Because you call if you need us. Because we got really good troops, and they're well shod, and we're ready to go. So peace out.
All right, Captain Darwin, Napoleonic warfare. Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumb in the eye.
I'll give it a thumbs up. I go along with the points that have been already stated that, yes, it's a very elegant, point in warfare. And I think it's pretty much you hit between, Civil War and Napoleonics, you're at the very end of that, I'll call it the gentleman's war, where everybody marches out, everybody fights, and at the end of the day, everybody kind of goes home and does their own thing and comes back out tomorrow and does it, because once we hit, you know, 1900, all bets are off, and we get into nasty trench warfare and, you know, tanks and planes and, you know, downright, you know, straight into the killing business. But if we didn't have it, yeah, we wouldn't have the hats, we wouldn't have the outfits, the flags, the buttons. And we wouldn't have, this, as pointed out, the start of what really became the professional warfare that, you know, led to tanks and planes and all sorts of nasty warfare down the road. So, yeah, I give it a thumbs up. I have, in fact, played a few Napoleonic games in my day, so.
On purpose? Or did you, like, lose a bet?
It was on purpose, and I enjoyed having my skirmishers tie up a whole bunch of people for, you know, basically days, so.
It was good.
Look, I, how can anybody possibly criticize Napoleonic warfare when tanks like the KV-2 exist?
It's a tough call.
It's elegant machinery.
Oh, yeah.
It's a tank with a phone booth on top of it.
It's a tank with a bunker on top of it.
Exactly. It's like somebody parked a bus on top of a tank chassis.
How can you not like that?
It looks like that was a two vodka bottle day.
So that's the Russians. That's the Russians for you, man.
I can't look at a KV-2 without. I mean, I assume that was the intent, right? Drove it out, and the Germans were so busy laughing.
But the same people came up with the T-34, which was an excellent vehicle.
Exactly, and you know, you got to give them props for the T-34. But I suspect that part of the success of the T-34 was.
It
Nobody
wasn't the
was KV-2. Looking at them because they were all laughing at the KV-2.
Well, you figure it this way, that they designed the KV-2, which was a thoroughly non-aesthetic piece of crap, and they designed the T-34, which was both an elegant design in both visual and in execution, right? So you figure they had one at the extreme high end and one at the extreme low end. They averaged out to two solid designs.
I think that just happens throughout all kinds of warfare, though.
Yeah,
but the whole history of Russian armor development is that. Even into the 50s, they were coming up from some really weird, weird shit, man.
And we still have that today, though.
Flying armored boats with curves on them. And,
right.
You know,
hey, look.
Okay,
we,
you can't be cracking on a Chronoplons. Those are very cool aerodynamic beasts.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have on this podcast one of the 12 breathing humans who knows the name of that thing.
Yeah, the loon. Well, they developed four or five different versions of those.
Yeah.
Let's also admit that Captain Darwin here may have at least a passing professional interest in trying to figure out how something that ugly could fly, given that his day job is rocket scientist.
I really don't call them ugly. You know, that gets into that whole thing where there's definitely some ugly stuff out there, and there's some good-looking aircraft. I happen to be a big fan of the de Havilland Mosquito, I think one of the most beautiful airplanes ever put in.
Oh, yeah.
And there's definitely been some ugly aircraft that have put out there, too. So.
And you got to admit, you know, one of the saving graces of the Mosquito is that it doesn't have a tank turret on it the size of a goddamn bus.
Well, at least in a couple versions where they were, you know, putting 57 millimeters and somewhat larger underneath them to go out and hunt subs. But, yeah.
All right, so while we're talking about really ugly things in the world of warfare, let's go back to picking on Napoleonics. Ugliest uniforms.
See, I thought that I had mostly.
Oh, no, 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 no. We are going to take that Napoleonic horse, and we are going to kick it to death. We're going to piss off PETA and feed a fed horse.
Yeah,
it's despite the day of the recording of this podcast being the birth of the U.S. Army's Armor Corps, we're still going to beat this Napoleonic horse to death. So, Cyrano, ugliest Napoleonic uniforms.
The Neapolitan Army.
Yeah.
The Neapolitan army was just this absurd melange of greens, blues with red facing, but it wasn't a proper French blue. It was this aqua. And, yeah, and then they had the pink uniforms.
Yeah, I was about to say, I thought we were going to go brown, white, and pink. I thought just like the ice cream.
Yeah, no, they had the pink.
Did they invent the purpose of putting all the buttons on cuffs so the soldiers wouldn't wipe their noses?
Yeah, I just, every time, you know, this is true story time. I was invited by the local gaming group that I was 16 at the time, and there was all these senior guys. They were like cops and firefighters and dentists. They were playing with minifigs 25s. They had armies of thousands. And they came up to me and they said, well, you have two choices. We all kind of got the Russians, French, the Germans, the British. They're all nailed. Everybody's playing them. So you can either borrow one of our armies, which would require you to base and flock these armies for us, or we'll let you play either the Dutch Belgians or the Neapolitans, which they had sitting to the side. I chose, it is indicative of how bad the Neapolitans were, that I chose the Dutch Belgians.
So you attacked them with waffles.
Oh, God. See, and I got to get this into a 15-second rant. The problem with most Napoleonic rules is, until recently, they fixed this recently, the Dutch-Belgian troops exist at multiple points over the period 1799 to 1815. They fight for both sides. And everybody at the time that I was learning to do this in the 80s was locked into essentially the Waterloo campaign, if not the Peninsular Wars. So I wind up with the Dutch Belgians who were really, really awful. You know, the guys that Wellington distrusted so deeply because, well, recently they'd been fighting for the French and he figured they'd defect, but also because they were such low quality, he winds up lining them up with his troops in the front so that A, they take most of the damage, but B, they're afraid to run away for fear of being shot. Still better than the Neapolitans.
Well, okay then.
Russian of him.
Doug, you have a preference on Napoleonic uniforms?
Well, I mean, he's already taken the Neapolitans. There is no question that the Neapolitans and, by reflection, almost any of the other Italian national armies, I think they're all pretty hideous. But I'm going to go with... Since Jim's already taken those, I'm gonna lay on the Portuguese.
Oh yeah.
Because you know when your entire uniform is the color of baby poop.
that's not wrong.
Yeah, I suppose it made it easy for them to hide. But it's a really ugly uniform.
Well,
having said that, the Portuguese, for all of their faults, were better troops than both the Dutch Belgians and the Neapolitans.
That is also correct.
Well, you know, when you set a bar that low, you know.
They didn't have to try very hard. But, the Portuguese uniforms are, if not the ugliest, the singularly least exciting uniforms of the Napoleonic Wars.
All right. So, Vance, we know you're not a fan of most things Napoleonic, but aside from the Kriegsspiels, has there been a Napoleonic game that you've played that you particularly enjoyed?
I have not played any Napoleonic games.
Other than the Kriegsspiels?
Other than the Kriegsspiels.
So... Jim, your game is Vance's favorite Napoleonic game of all time.
And it's also his least favorite.
That's right.
Well, I wasn't going to go there. I was trying to be positive on this one.
No. As I said, I've always been grateful to him for giving it a shot and playing it with a good spirit of aplomb. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, all right, I'm most impressed of is after the first one, after 18 months of
get my ass kicked,
basically having his head inside a bucket, getting hit by a hammer.
Why everybody?
Right.
I took on the entire freaking French army.
Right, right. Basically, there he is going, come at me, bro. Right? And so after that experience, caught at the end of the game in a burning town, the second game comes up, and who's almost at the front of the line?
I am.
Comes back
There's
for more.
Vance. There's Vance. I am
hoping beyond hope that I could redeem myself by maybe switching sides.
Right.
But no.
No.
No, no, no. I have yet to get an Austrian.
Oozing about the map. Just get to ooze around the map there, huh?
No, no, see, that's, it's the on the map part that's a little hard right now.
Yeah, that's the problem. I think we kind of picked a scenario where we didn't actually realize it was going to kind of take a long, long time for half of the players to actually get involved.
Well, see, and see, part of the fun, one of the reasons the guy who designed the game loves this scenario so much, it is a classic back and forth.
Yeah.
One side has a huge advantage, and then over time it goes away. The problem is Didier Roy, MD, he tends to play this game in a house with people over the course of a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and therefore, Vance's wait time, you know, he can grab a snack, watch a movie, and get periodic updates, and then jump in the afternoon and have fun.
Yeah, in our game, Vance actually has enough time to raise a child.
I have enough time to invent my own version of Kriegsspiel.
Yes.
Does it involve toddlers and small
I was getting there. You jumping the gun on me here. All right, so Captain Darwin, you mentioned you've actually had Napoleonic games hit the table. Preference?
Well, in this case, it was invited to do a miniatures game elsewhere. But, yes, I've actually thrown dice and moved little guys around and skirmished and held up people and generally, you know, played a spoiler in that one.
So not enough of them to really have much of a preference one way or the other.
No, it kind of drops well kind of below my, you know, 1900s threshold for materials that I know about enough to be dangerous. So if I'm going to game, I'm going to stick to, you know, air warfare in the First World War and start to branch out as I hit the Second World War and into modern and, we'll say near future points here.
Yeah. Well, so Cyrano, we have multiple articles detailing some of your favorite Napoleonic games. What are one or two of your least favorite out there and why?
Oh, you're making me do this.
Yes. Yes. I want you throwing some shade here. Spread some hate around.
Is it going to be shade or is it going to be throwing some purple color around?
Yeah, maybe. Doug, we're coming your way next, so you actually get to think about it a little. I'm just going to put Jim on the spot.
I mean, the first thing I'm going to say is, I'll be able to say this because I can say something positive and something negative. I hate any Napoleonic game that plays above its intended size. There's a natural impulse with Napoleonic gamers that if this game works really, really well, maneuvering a bunch of battalions inside a brigade, inside a division, that naturally all it takes is these six crazy guys that we got joined together here on the podcast to each get their division, and we'll have an army battle, and it'll be five times as good.
That's not a Napoleonic flaw. Everybody does that.
Yeah. Everybody does that, yeah.
So I was going to say, Jim. An armored brigade where they're trying to fight divisions on a map that's meant for three squirrels and a rabbit.
Yeah, you just defined
a particularly big rabbit.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Jim, you've just defined the reason that SPI's NATO Division Commander existed.
See, yeah. and for me, the moment where that clicked was when I went to Historicon and met with some very, very good friends. And I had signed up in advance. You know, you sign up in advance. You get one game a day back in those days. You get two these days. But you got one game. And my game was a 25-millimeter Vagram. And they were doing Vagram at the battalion scale.
Ouch.
And you sit there and you read the description, and I knew the guys. Oh, by the way, did I mention they're doing it in 25-millimeter?
Yeah, I was going to say, did they use a football field?
Well, no, it's seriously, if you've been to this was still at the host. If you've been to the host, it had these really long conference rooms. This sucker was on 25 feet of table with an L shape built into it. I, for reasons I don't recall, it may have been the booze coma I wound up in, because Rifleman Harris from the Sharp series, who travels now around being this guy from Sharp, he was there, and we all went out drinking with him. And had a wonderful time. He let us play with the muskets or the rifles and things. But I got named to be Napoleon. And I swear, none of those units that I was trying to command moved more than 2 feet. And that was, by the way, over a 14-hour day.
Is that a feature or a bug?
So Shacko and Shacko 2, I really think I prefer Shacko 1 these days, but Shacko is a great system when you play it in the scale for which it's intended. When you metastasize that rule set, it breaks utterly and becomes an unusable mess. And I told Dave Waxtell this some years ago, and he disagreed with me passionately, and frankly, he's just wrong. The other two I will single out. One is Avalon Hills Waterloo. It's an important piece of history. You should study it. You should know it. But as I think I said on this very podcast, it's got the same CRT as Stalingrad.
Yeah, it's Panzer Blitz with muskets.
Yeah, so it was part of a time, it was part of a thing, don't bother. The other one is the old, I'll even throw shade on an old SPI game, Napoleon's First Battles. The Jena Auerstadt game in there is, well, first of all, don't get anywhere near the Decision Games version. Set that on fire. That's evil and wrong. They did a system by which the divisions were identified by colors that are indistinguishable from each other. You know, so I'm sitting there with my son going, is this fuchsia? Because Donzelo is fuchsia. Is that fuchsia? And so that's horrible. But even the original is a little too much. We got to get a game about Napoleon. Everybody likes games about Napoleon. Let's put four battles together and hopefully they'll work. And they conspicuously don't feel Napoleonic. The other one that has not aged well with me, and I actually set it up just last week to fool with it, is Martin Wallace's Waterloo. It's the one that gets the bad rap because it's got all the wooden pieces, and it became known as the Napoleonic Euro game. It other people called it the Toy Krieg game. I just bounced off it. I bounced off it at first. I tried to like it, and now I just can't. I've got it. I'm going to keep it, but just because I have to have them all. But yeah, those would be the ones right offhand that if you said, would you want to play these because it's Napoleonic, I'd look at you sadly and say, can't we play this instead?
Can't we play anything else instead?
Yeah, so those would be my four.
All right. Doug, it doesn't have to be quite as structured as Jim was there, but some Napoleonic games you're not a fan of.
In general, am not a fan of Napoleonic strategic games.
Oh, this is a good point.
There have been a couple that have come out that they've tried to handle it. Most recently, you know, Matrix released one that was an Asiad game. Was a remake. It was their second stab at it. And I thought the first one got a lot of was probably the least liked Asiad game up to that point, or Asiad, however it's pronounced. The the next Napoleon game, just, it was too big for its britches, I think. Tried to do too much, and it doesn't really work. I don't find it particularly fun, but a lot of the strategic Napoleonic games I don't really enjoy. It's not, the essence of Napoleonic warfare is operational. That was his particular genius, and that's where I think there's the most to learn, and I think a lot of times the strategic games are just missing the boat. In terms of specific games, I don't have a lot that I don't like, though I would say that probably the one that I just was thinking of this, and I've just spaced it.
It was so bad, you don't even want to mention it.
Well, I was listening to Jim, and I thought, yeah, he mentioned something, and I was like, yeah, I remember what it was. And Jim's gonna think of this as sacrilege, but let me explain. Wellington's Victory. One of the most classic Waterloo games. And it's not so much that I dislike the rules. It's the edition that I have. I have the TSR Wellington's Victory. And I've always found it impossible to play because it was printed so badly.
Yes.
That the counters are almost unreadable. And there's a good game in there, but I just can't play it because I get the counters out, I sort them, I look at it, and I go, you know, it's obvious that the same guy that designed the KV2 ran the printer.
All I will say about Wellington's Victory is for those who are going to join us on our tabletop simulator adventures that we hope to have as the Armchair Dragoons in the coming months, I will set up a video just where I show the viewers out there what Wellington's Victory looks like set up. It's in, they have a mod, they have a module for it. It is amazing.
It is.
It is remarkable to see, even with its weird mustard-colored terrain. But at the same time, Doug is absolutely right. Whoever set the die for this was higher than Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just, I have no idea what this person thought they were doing when they were punching out those little bitty squares, because half the British are at least a quarter inch to the bad. And I went out, because this is what I do, and I bought a whole nother set thinking I just have one that's jacked up.
Nope.
And nope. The other one I bought was in the exact same shape. And I asked Don about this for Enterprise Games, Friends of Armchair Dragoons. I said, Don, could you just pull the lids off a couple of them and tell me every last one?
Yeah, it's the whole print run. Every single game that was ever printed is misprinted.
And now, if you tell me that this is a game with 100 counters, I'm like, oh, figure it out. This is
no.
A game with over 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're all wrong.
Yes.
There's not a single counter of the 2,000 that isn't misprinted.
So we're not scanning these to make our own, you know, homemade sets of counters, huh?
Not a prayer.
No, yeah. No, and if I were to do it, if I were to play it now, it would be in Tabletop Simulator. There's no question in my mind. First of all, it's a big sucker of a game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is, you're not going to fit it on a 6x4. And secondly, I don't like leaving stuff up that long, although I do have the room to do it. And third, you know, if I can have some people over and just move it around the table, I'll see you later, why not? So you laugh at
the guy who ran an 18-month long Creech field. Is concerned. He's
what?
Concerned about how long he's leaving a game set up.
Ah, now you're picking on me.
If I recall, you had to make way at the table for Christmas dinner twice for that Kriegspiel.
Yes, that is true. I had to explain to my in-laws what the heck the map was. Yeah, that is true.
And the scary part is, Wellington's victory set up probably takes longer to play than that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It really does. I'm not sure. I mean, Wellington's victory is sort of the Africa campaign of Napoleonic gaming in a lot of ways.
I'm going to use that for a massive pivot here, talking about a really big game. And it's interesting because
we're going to pivot. After I threw up, now we're going to pivot.
Now we're going to pivot. Well, no, because you're talking about a really big game. This is interesting. I was actually, somebody reached out to me as, you guys are going to laugh at this one, as one of the wargaming industry market experts, looking for independent verification of largest commercially available war game. So I'm just going to throw this out to you guys. What is the largest commercially available? So not like a custom something, not a custom terrain kit for a bunch of minis, but an actual board game, the largest physical space size counter, you know, count of counters, whatever. What's the largest one that you've ever actually seen? Vance, what do you got? What do you think?
GDW's Third World War. All four packs together.
Yes. All four of them together?
Yeah, yep. I played that at Game On a couple of years ago.
That one's pretty big once you put all four together. The challenge there is that's four separate games, as you know, according to the Guinness Book of World Records guys. That's four separate games.
Aww.
So, all right. Because another comparable one to that is if you put all of the SPI, S&T, Fifth Corps games together, they take up a crap ton of space also, but that's considered four or five separate games. So, it is an impressive experience, though. You're absolutely right. Captain, what do you think?
I was going to jump on the SPI games because they're kind of monstrous, but I would say if you took, like, Harpoon, the box set with the cardboard, because then you got to put those out there on the floor at scale and you have some distance, so that could take up some real estate, and that's in one box.
Yeah. That one doesn't have a map, though. You use the floor for it, correct?
True. So, I mean, you'd have to have, like, a blue floor so it looked like water.
But, well, yeah. So, I'm not sure that one fits in the category just because of the the lack of map. But that one absolutely could take up a ton of space if you do it at scale. You're definitely right there. Doug, what do you think?
I was going a similar direction with, in terms of ones I've actually seen, I was going to go with Jutland.
Yeah, laid out on the floor.
I've played Jutland full scale, yeah.
Yeah, but it has the same problem, right? It's not a map.
Yeah, you need a gymnasium to play it on.
Yeah, you need a gym, right?
Yep. all right, Cyrano.
I did not see the one they had up at Consim World. I saw the ads for it, so I don't think I get to count that absurdity. I would have to think it's Europa, the full game setup that they ran at Gen Con all those years.
Yeah.
Now, that's a combination of sheer map size, which I think might fall in line with Case Blue setup, which I've seen, and a couple others, as well as the Marshall Enterprise Labatt games, which are gigantic.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're pretty big.
But Europa has the distinction of combining an absurd map size with a piece density that makes one dread pepper like a bad rash.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you're going to sneeze and dislocate hours of work. So yeah. I'll say the old Europa games that ran annually at Gen Con for many years.
So for a bit of a cheating answer, some of you guys probably have seen this setup at either Gen Con or at Origins. Jim, remember back when Glenn was still working at Eagle Games and they used to show up with the 9x12 rug for attack?
Sure.
And walk around on the rug? That's cheating slightly, but that 9x12 rug, you could actually order one. It's not like they had them on the shelf and you could just go buy them, but you could order them. So technically, that 108 square foot map was commercially available. But
was it in the box?
Good point.
The one that's actually
splitting hairs.
Yeah. The one that's actually looking like it's gonna end up with the record from Guinness is one that has 130 square feet of map, which exceeds a 9x12 rug, if you think about that for a second, and over 23,000 counters. And it's the staff ride edition of Grognard Sim's Death Ride Kursk Su.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one.
That comes in the big wooden crate.
I thought you were going to say it was My Little Pony.
No.
Well, there's a variant rule.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There's nothing little about this one.
Panzers, yeah.
So Vance, we're getting back to some Panzers for you. I'm sure there's a KV-2 counter in there somewhere. There's got to be at least one.
Falls over a lot.
It does.
Yeah. I mean, it's cursed, right? There's a KV-2 in there somewhere. But yeah, it's 130 square feet of map, which is enormous. At Consim World this past year, they gave it its own room.
Oh yeah,
you had to. You had to.
How do you play something like that when you can't even really reach into the middle of the map?
So
without like 10-foot long tongs.
What I'm envisioning is something like the rig from the first Mission Impossible where you're sort of dangling by some ropes. But then I remember the sort of physique and body type that most wargamers have. And
it's a bad plan, man.
And at that point, you've got to play it in like an auto body repair shop so that you can use a chain hoist to move people around. But I'll be honest, Darwin, I got no idea how you would play that. I really don't. Unless the map was not like a perfect 130 that it was, you know, kind of like Cyrano was describing where you had a big L shape in the middle somewhere such that you could walk around part of the battle. It's just enormous. I mean, it's, you know, the thing is DAC 2, the OCS game has a flipping huge map, right? I mean, you could wallpaper your house with that thing. But it's a long, narrow map, so you can always get to it, right? North Africa's long and skinny, and so you can always get to every part of the map on that one, even though you need to set it up with, like, a pair of scrolling wheels on either end of the table so that you can just, you know, keep adjusting it to play. I honestly have no idea how you would play around 130 square feet of map, because, like, the fascination of attack on the 9x12 rug is that you can walk on the rug. You know, you can walk around on the map to move things around.
Now, wait a minute. Matrix published World in Flame.
Yeah.
With that, they put out a 22x16 map.
Yeah, the World in Flames, the commercially available edition actually came in slightly smaller because I've seen the chart that's got all the square footage of everything. Hang on just a second. Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Yeah, but the Matrix Games map that they published was 22 feet long by 8 or 10 feet wide.
Yeah, hang on just a second. World in Flames, the square footage measurement, the Australian Design Group World in Flames was 21.3 square feet. It was, in square inches, it was 3,069 square inches. Whereas the Death Ride Kursk Sud Front staff one, 18,700 and change for square inches. 130 square feet. So.
I think the Matrix World. The wall map is better, is bigger.
I think the argument is though, it doesn't come with counters.
It doesn't come with counters.
Yeah.
That's
come in the game.
It's just a map.
Right. It's just a map. Right. That's not the complete game. And that's the thing the Eagle Games rug one that you could order, you got the pieces with it, right? They gave you the figures that went with it.
How thick is the box at that point?
It's wooden.
if you took like a huge Mark Walker size box and started folding that map up, I mean that map's still got to be what, 3 inches thick?
Well, so the Death Ride Kursk one, I mean it's multiple maps because it all pieces together, and you can do multiple maps. It doesn't have to be a single map. It's multiple maps, but it is seriously, it is a crate. It is the size of a coffee table. Yeah,
Yeah, it's actually the size of an ammo crate. I'm looking at it right here.
Yeah,
there's a guy sitting on it.
The Europa fire in the east isn't that big. Wow.
No, the other ones that are close. So the current world record holder is called the War Game World War II from Pegasus Games.
Yes.
And that one comes in at 20 square feet, 20.8. Defraction Enterprises has a Mare Nostrum game that comes in at 84 square feet. But it is not as big as the Grognard Sims, you know, Death Ride Cursed that comes in at 130 square feet.
And the other thing with Europa, remember, it's never been available in one box.
Yeah. Well, but even just the Fire in the East box is pretty darn huge.
Oh, yeah. But no, and to answer, there's two things I wanted to say to Captain Darwin. First of all, it's an L shape. I'm looking at it here. I found the concept page. It's a big L shape. Although, I will tell you, my vision being what it is, I could never play this game. Because they've got space all the way around it, the L, so that you can obviously set drinks because you don't want it on the map. And you could maybe set pieces. So my guess, just conservatively looking at this, is it's a 4 to 5 foot reach to the middle of one of these maps. Wow. I have no earthly idea. They show a human for scale in one of these pictures. And it is to Brand's point, I think you are lowering some... some ovoid gamer from a harness down with a tweezers and a headlamp trying to move these pieces.
Let me ask, you mentioned they show a human for scale. Do they show a human or do they show a wargamer?
Wargamer.
Because those are two different scales.
That's 1.67 humans on average. I'm just looking at this picture and I'm looking at the dude setting it up. I see no incredible way. Now I really do want to see this, how he ever reached the middle of this map. I don't think it would be physically possible unless you get up and crawl on the map.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You have to start by setting the units in the middle while you're crawling on the map and then backing out.
Fine. How do you move it? Right.
I don't think you do. I think the game takes so long you never get to those units.
Yeah, that's probably why, right? Nobody's ever moved those.
And I go back, it's not, to me, it's not even really a game. I don't think you can frame it in air quotes game if it takes longer to set up than it does to play.
Oh, but setting up is half of the fun.
See, I disagree because, you know, we picked up Firefly when it first came out because the wife's a big Firefly fan. And, you know, you look at this game and it's in a huge box and then you start opening it up and then there's, you know, 70 million little pieces and tokens. It took us 3 hours of punching stuff out, organizing it. By the time we got all that done, we were out of time to play the thing.
Yeah, that's not a war game, though.
No, but see, war games could be just as bad. If you've got to set up 35, you know, million square feet of map and take out, you know, 75,000 counters
every five years,
and hoist people over.
Every five years, I dig out my copy of Europa France.
Okay.
Set up all 2,300 counters on the maps, on my table, look at it lovingly for like 3 weeks, and then put it all away.
Take pictures of it.
I don't even take pictures. I just stare at it. It's just...
I completely am with you, Vance. 100%. I have done the exact same thing with 3 Labatt games.
Just the sheer joy of setting up the units and understanding where they are and thinking about it and just staring at it and then put it all away, and 5 years later I'll do it again.
You know, if you had any friends, you could play it.
No, you can't.
I don't like people.
We're back to the thing. Yeah, you can't.
No, you can't. It's not playable.
I'm serious.
I am looking at this Death Ride. I just want you all to be able to see. I'm going to cut and paste this into the
feed. I'm looking at it right now.
I'm going to paste this right. I can do this. We have the technology.
It's an audio podcast. Nobody can see it.
Well, you know, listeners can wait. But
just put some links into the front page.
Send a self-addressed stamped envelope.
To armchairdragoons.com. Mentioned in dispatches. But it's, you know, seriously, you can't play this game.
You can't reach the middle of the map. There's no way.
I'm just having visions of Vance. Bombs. Yeah, I'm just having visions of Vance dangling from a fishing line.
But my other point to Captain Darwin was, and I absolutely respect this piece, and I wish, you know, he made the comment earlier that he's got this focus from World War One aeronautics forward. I wish, of course I love Napoleonics first and foremost and always, but I've got, and Doug and I have talked about this for a long time, you know, all equal, 30 years war, sure. Ancients, why not? American Civil War, yes. Revolutionary War, who cares, sure. World War II, you bet. I wish I had the focus these Death Ride cursed guys have. Because as absurd as I find this exercise, there is something admirable in at least giving this a shot. To Captain Darwin's point, by the time you have laid out the map, much less the pieces, I'm going to go play another game.
No, you will have, by that point, purchased an entire series of games
that I would never play.
Helped the designer of that game rewrite the rules manual. Taught your son to play.
In hopes that his grandchildren will one day be able to play the game.
And sent him to college. This isn't.
He keeps saying this like it's a bad thing.
No, I'm looking at this map. This is not a game. This is a lifestyle.
It's a career.
It really is. I mean, if you decided to do this, you'd have to decide you were doing it absolutely no later than when you were 21. And this would be the game you would play for the rest of your life. You wouldn't play anything else.
Well, you're reaching and approaching a size and dedication of someone who gets into model trains and converts their entire basement into one large, you know, run of half of North America with 700 trains. And
how is that a bad thing?
I'm looking at this, I kind of think it's not a bad thing.
And that might answer how pieces move out of the middle.
I kind of think they're included.
They're on a train. But, okay, and now this gets, you know, okay, now this is officially a rewarding rabbit hole. There is a YouTube video, See It Played, Death Ride Kursk Liebstandarte.
Oh, you have to send that link around.
Oh, yeah, because here's the thing. Dude who's doing this video with all the 72 views, I don't know him. I'm sure he's wonderful. But he's focusing on a battle, let me measure this, that is 20 hexes across and 15 hexes deep. And his video runs for 15 minutes.
Well, let's be clear here. So the Liebestandarte one that you're looking at is one of the modules that's nested within the Staff Ride Edition. That is right. Only one of about 14 boxes that are in there.
Right. So he takes 15 minutes to explain the mechanics of a game, and he uses this. Oh, my God, I'm looking at these counters. I would blow my brains out.
They're like half-inch counters, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, God, half-inch counters should be a bull.
That thing, I no, but oh, and I think this is like
not,
Kursk
he fought at not the, trimmed his counters.
This is Kursk at the company level or something, isn't it?
Yeah, by the look of it, yeah, by what he's doing here. But I'm saying,
you couldn't trim all those counters in a lifetime.
I'm willing to try.
and I'm going to guess that the leftover debris is somehow going to be against the law in any that's like out there burning wood in the wintertime.
I was going to make the case that it would be the rare time that you could take your counter trimmings and actually have enough of them to get money back at the recycling center.
you could mix them with some water. Build an adobe house out of them.
But yeah, it is companies based on the insignia I'm looking at here. And he's spending, again, he's using tweezers, let that be observed. And he's going for 15 minutes to explain this little piece of the. I'm out.
And it's all going to come down to a D6 on a table of factors.
Yes.
I love that our resident Napoleonicist.
I was going to make the comment.
Is the one who's out right. On a large and complicated game.
Oh, I see how this is going to end now.
Well, not only that, but that the guy who is most readily agreeing with him is the guy who's busy building an army of 2-millimeter miniatures.
Because you know what? I can play this one-to-one now.
And it's easier to put them in a closet than a bunch
of
dressed up toddlers.
How can you see 2-millimeter figures?
You can't.
Yeah.
So you can't. You actually cannot see 2-millimeter figures. What you can see is a battalion of 2-millimeter figures.
No, you see a battalion of little tiny pewter sticks.
They're not even pewter.
Yeah, I was going to say they're not even sticks.
You know how you create a battalion of 2-millimeter miniatures is you take all the corners you trimmed off your other counters and just glue them to bases upright in an upright position.
Actually, it's not quite that, but there are people that are making 2-millimeter armies out of hair curlers. You know, those plastic hair curlers?
Yeah.
And, paint them up just a little bit, and from 4 or 5 feet away, it looks like a Roman legion. And given that Jim's eyesight and my eyesight together
is not one normal human.
Right. The fact that there's sort of a blurry mass of
blue and green.
Right. That's all we're going to see anyway, man. It's perfectly fine.
It's going to work. You kind of shake your head a little bit, a little paradelia. You're all good.
Right.
They look like
five or six beers before you start. It's good.
Exactly. It's just fine.
You talk about links we should put up. You got to see the guy that is inspiring Doug and me on this subject. There is a dude who is doing the Battle of Leipzig. He's doing 1-to-1. The largest battle of the Napoleonic Wars. And he's doing it at 1-to-1 using these 2-millimeter figures, and it looks awesome.
It really does. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, we're both looking at it. That's I have vowed never to paint again, but Doug is. And I wish him well as he wanders down the rabbit hole. But it's quite the thing. But no, to the subject at hand, I guess if you wanted to win the record and do all these cool things, because certainly they got a lot of buzz on the internet about it, but still.
See, what was great about this is when I was rounding up participants for tonight, you guys were wondering what we were going to actually have to talk about. and we're at an hour. And
secretly, you want us to develop the largest war game just so you can get it in Guinness Books.
Oh, there no. No, 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 no. Because at some point, all of y'all are going to look at me and go, hey, we need a graphics guy. And
okay, just for the record, did we mention how much this game costs?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
$2,500. And here's my favorite line. Please contact me with your questions regarding postage. Yeah.
Well, for one, it's got to be, shipped by UPS. Somebody's got to have a forklift to take it to your door.
Well, the game comes packaged in a KV-2 turret.
Look, here's the thing. Think about who the actual market is for this $2,500 game, and what are the odds that that person isn't going to be at something like a Historicon, a Consim World, a WBC, or an Origins, that he couldn't just show up and deliver it because he's going to be there anyway.
Right.
He's definitely a very lonely millionaire. That's exactly right. That's,
yeah, God bless him.
Well, if he's in Texas, he's also going to pay 8.25% sales tax.
And by the way, you notice where they don't have estimates for shipping? They have it for U.S., Japan, and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Not for Canada.
Nothing for you.
$2,000 in shipping.
That's true. Nothing for you.
Well, again, they know they're going to clip the corners of the counters and create a mess.
But I want you to think about this for a minute. 8.25% sales tax on a $2,500 game.
That's like 4 Labatt games.
It's almost your gaming budget for the year just in sales tax.
That's what Doug spends on little ships at Origins.
That's pretty much it.
He had a coupon. You back off.
I did have a coupon.
That didn't stop him from spending the same amount. That just meant he got more.
Exactly.
They were on sale.
The way you wave the coupons around because that's how you tell your wife, I didn't spend a lot of money on all this. I had coupons.
All this money. That's the whole
point. Same thing you hear from her or the rest of the year.
Yeah.
I saved you so much money with these coupons.
If I hadn't, think of the money we would have lost if I hadn't have bought these things.
All right, guys. I think we've maxed out on the amusement for the night. We're right around an hour, which again we try to keep these to a DC commute, and so I think we're right around an hour, and again you guys were worried we weren't going to have much to talk about. So, Captain Darwin, thank you for joining us. Vance, appreciate you being here. Cyrano, Doug, thank you as always. Again, I love having you guys here because I can just throw out two questions and get out of the way, and an hour later we got a podcast. It's great. So Jim, I hope you survived the Napoleonic hate that we had to throw around on this one just cause. But I knew it would make a great impromptu topic so that the rest of us didn't have to prepare for much. So,
well, that is the real glory of Death Ride Cursed Sud. It makes everything Napoleonic look normal.
That's right.
Everything.
And, no, not everything. KV2 still looks weird.
No, that's not Napoleonic though.
Oh, that's true.
Yes. So on that note, thank you everybody for joining us on Mentioned in Dispatches here. Please join us at armchairdragoons.com when you get a chance. And, we've got two or three more episodes of this before we're going to take a break around the holidays and, come back and see everybody after the new year with with season two of the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast. We ought to use the name of the podcast a little more often on the podcast. We've only had it like a week and a half, so, we're still breaking it. Thanks, everybody, and we'll catch you later.